Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello, this is the Red Box Podcast. I'm Matt Shawley. Before we get stuck into what's coming up on today's episode, let's take a look at what we've learned this week. Shocked I was. My flabber was ghasted. It turns out I was so busy with my main job that I hadn't noticed, but apparently I've been an MP on the side for years. Yeah. But to fight, I will not give in to the media mob. The good, honest, hard-working people of wherever it is I'm an MP for will decide whether or not I should carry on doing whatever it is I've been doing from wherever it is I've been doing it. The thing is, there are upsides to MPs having second jobs, or as Cabinet Minister Anne-Marie Trevelyan put it,
they bring a richness.
And they don't have more richness than Sir Geoffrey Cox. What first drew you to the British Virgin Islands, Geoffrey?
The full midday beam.
Well, yes, the weather is nice. Phileas Cox has been around the world in 80 pay days, but remains unrepentant about being a top-class barrister. Owen Paterson must be wishing he could afford him. Still, it prompted us to play a brand new game called
Cox or Commons.
But it turns out that's just two words describing a group of MPs. Talking of word games that get slightly out of hand, this was ITV's lingo.
Boner, B-O-N-E-R.
Boner, B-O-N-E-R. Yes, it's a word. And by the way, the definition of boner is a mistake or blunder.
Which means it's totally fine to say that in British politics we do have a lot of boners. In completely unrelated news, three MPs were criticised for getting drunk on a flight to meet troops in Gibraltar. Because if there's one thing we've learned about the army recently, there are sensitive souls unfamiliar with the idea of drinking too much and behaving appallingly. Elsewhere, we inched closer to a deal which might save the planet, although hopes of cutting methane emissions were dashed by Joe Biden giving Camilla a toot of his favourite national anthem.
The United States.
And in the middle of it all, Boris Johnson declared
the UK is not remotely a corrupt country.
Without adding, but we're working on it, all part of global Britain. Sure, they are the minority, but the thing about bad eggs is they don't half stink. The only good thing is that most Tory MPs are now wearing masks in the Commons, although mainly to cover their faces in case anyone recognises them. You see, we learn so much, Right, coming up on today's episode, on a similar theme, it has to be said. Sleaze. When was the sleaziest time in British politics? Was it Joy Cash for Questions in the 1990s? Was it MPs' expenses in the noughties? Or is it what's going on right now in British politics? Which is the worst, the 90s, the noughties, or now? We've assembled a panel of veteran sleaze busters. And we'll do that coming up on the podcast. First, though, we kick off, as ever, with our columnist panel. And today, because it's Friday, it must be Melanie Reed and James Forsyth. Let's talk about... I sort of feel like... Is this steam coming out? Are we running out of steam in the sleaze scandal, if you like, James? You're a good barometer of these. You've seen how these. There's always this rule: if it's on the front pages for 7 days or more, that it starts really harming the government. The polls have narrowed a bit. Is there anywhere else for it to go? Or is this all over now? Will we still be talking about it next week?
I think there is a similarity with the expenses scandal in that I think there are arrangements that are entirely within the rules, but most of the public would think, how on earth is that allowed? And I think the one of those at the moment is that if you take money from some interest, as long as you declare that interest, you can speak in debates or ask parliamentary questions that touch on that interest. And I think that that is the thing that the public are going to find very, very strange. That as long as you say, you know, I draw attention to my entry in the Register of Members' Interests, you can then ask a question essentially in the, you know, to the benefit of the people that you are working for. And I think that is, I mean, the public are going to find that to be very, very odd.
Yeah, I suppose that's the thing, isn't it? And you're right. So even the story, which is was on the Times today, MPs fill pockets using rent expenses loophole. The point is, that's the rules. To try and stop MPs claiming for mortgages and essentially then saying, you know, they were told they then had to rent. So the complaint is that some MPs already own a flat, say, in London, but they can't claim any money for that, so they're maybe renting that one other one out, and then they're claiming to rent a different flat, which is all entirely within the rules, but it doesn't necessarily always pass the smell test.
And I mean the issue is that, you know, when the public mood turns, as one MP put it this week, you know, transparency is no defense. You can come out and, you know, and it is worth remembering that, you know, David Cameron in 2009 forced, and Gordon Brown did the same for Labour MPs, they forced them to repay lots of expenses money which had been approved. So they weren't forced to repay money that they shouldn't have claimed. They were forced to repay money which, you know, on a technical level, they had their expenses had been perfectly fine. But public anger was such that they thought the only way they could move on was to say, okay, we'll pay that money back. And I think this is, the danger is that, you know, how do you move on? How do you basically say, look, we've sorted this out? And I think at the moment, the government are hoping that this thing will blow itself out. You know, let the House of Commons Standards Committee look at this, you know, long grass it all. But I think if it goes on much longer, I think the pressure for them to do something, to act, will grow. I think one of the things that is reducing the pressure on them, though, is that, you know, Keir Starmer isn't really coming forward with any suggestions. If you think back to, you know, 2009, you know, David Cameron kept getting ahead of Gordon Brown. David Cameron kept saying, well, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. And Gordon Brown was then forced to play catch up. Starmer isn't really putting Boris Johnson under that kind of pressure.
Melanie, as our sort of barometer of the view, almost as far away from the Westminster bubble as you can possibly get, how's all this playing out for you?
I see it that it's absolutely right that it will drop down, calm down a bit now. But I think that the longer term is that the Tory party is trying to attract a different type of voter. I mean, the whole red wall, the red wallers versus the red corders, as James puts in his column today so nicely. Those people that are voting for MPs, MPs for whom 82,000 salary is a lot of money, for whom those in the South, and it's just a starting salary. Again, that's, you know, James's lovely turn of phrase. So there's this, you know, people who do not have a lot of money, they really value it. And these are the new constituency for the Tory party that they need if they want to stay away from a hung parliament. And I think paying the money back, as James says, it's what you do if you're not well off and you're in trouble and you're looking a bit dodgy, then you pay it back. And I think it would certainly help allow them to move forward.
The interesting thing about your column, James, and red wall and red calls is very good. I can't believe
sadly not mine. It's the cabinet minister's rather good joke.
You're very generous to credit them in your column, because I'd have just taken that. But the point is that this actually isn't an either or equation, is it, for Boris Johnson? That in order for him to continue to be the election winning machine, He needs both, because he needs both the red cords to stick with him. And obviously the electoral genius, if you like, was that he managed to add the red wallers. But he can't... He's right to be concerned about keeping the red wallers, but he does need to make sure he then doesn't lose the traditional Conservative base, whether that's going, you know, potentially Lib Dem or possibly Labour. You know, he does have to hold on to both of those, doesn't he?
Yeah, and especially because parliamentary parties are much harder to manage than they were in the past. So, you know, back in the day, you might have thought a majority of 40 or 50 was enough for a government to get its business through. We've already seen that with a government majority of 80, the government have had to U-turn on a whole host of issues, you know, including planning, which was their biggest supply-side reform, because they couldn't get it past their parliamentary party. And I think this is what is so tricky for him. He is trying to keep together this broad coalition. And, you know, and this is, I think, one of the challenges about levelling up, which is, you know, how do you manage to deliver tangible progress so that, you know, in the red wall at the next election, when it comes, you can say, well, look, you know, we voted Tory for the first time and things have got better. How do you manage to do that in the time frame, given how deep-seated the issues that lots of those constituencies face are, without just kind of throwing money at it? And if you throw money at it, then that means, you know, you're going to have to put up taxes again, or certainly won't be able to cut taxes before the next election. And that risks alienating those traditional Tory heartlands in the south.
And I suppose, actually, I was making that distinction between sort of red wall voters and red called voters. But actually, the divide, one of the impacts of this sleaze just sort of covers everything. But this massive, particularly the Owen Paterson row, has driven a huge wedge, hasn't it, between those two groups of MPs. The 2019 intake of Conservative MPs make up about a third of all Tory MPs. And they are livid about this, in part because they think they've been tarred with a brush which they didn't need to be tarred with, but also just don't understand it. Why was the entire Conservative Party mobilised to protect, like, essentially an old duffer like Owen Paterson?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of anger that they have basically had to cop a lot of abuse for trying to do something that was so clearly going to cause problems. And I think one of the other things that they're cross about is, you know, that, you know, they feel that they kind of weren't asked before, but they were marched up this hill. They marched up this hill kind of, you know, not of any, you know, someone said to me, you know, there are 250 Tory MPs in that lobby, and only about 12 of them wanted to be there in a kind of active way. And then they immediately start getting all these emails saying, what on earth are you doing? Can't believe you did this. Only to find the government completely abandoning its position before lunch the next day.
Melanie, I just wonder whether we are wrong to start writing off Boris Johnson. Anyone who's ever done that has always been, including I've done this myself many times.
I don't think
you
ever can, but I do think it does play badly, and he's going to have to do something. He really is the interesting thing is that of those red wall seats, how many of them have outside interests? I mean, a quarter of MPs have outside interests. I bet you that those red wall seats aren't amongst them. So, you know, it's...
There's such a difference between, you know, being paid to write an article for a newspaper and being paid by a international... globally listed company to raise your concerns in the House of Commons. There's such a, you know, that even that covers a broad thing. But also, I suppose it does also, the point you make does also point to the fact that the MPs most likely to be seen as useful to companies are those who've been in the cabinet before and have contacts and knowledge. And so you sort of have to ask yourself, well, that's, you know, that again points to whether or not they should necessarily... they shouldn't necessarily be doing that. Let's turn our attention to something else, just because I feel like we've all slightly agreed with each other. A total change. What's going on at Durham University? I think you picked this one out, Melanie.
Yeah, I mean, this had me out, my eyes out on stalks, frankly. Durham University, a Russell Group university. The students are being supported. The student union is being supported in advising some of the female students, maybe male too, I'm not sure, to offer sexual services, to become sex workers. You know, it's a jaw dropper that actually the institution is supporting young women, mostly, I think, young women, to become men's playthings, to enter that horrible world of commercial sexual exploitation. I mean, it's a toast, a marmalade dropper. It really is.
I was like you. I was baffled. A marmalade dropper is a great phrase. But I was genuinely. So the university insists the training was important to ensure students could be safe and make informed choices after noting an emerging trend of students selling sexual services. A part of me just thought, why doesn't the university maybe offer some other advice on how there are other options if you want to, you know, you need to make some money or something? It has been condemned by the university's minister, Michelle Donnellan, who said it was legitimising a dangerous industry and badly failing their duty to protect. Because it's also illegal, James. That's the other thing.
I think this is just so mad. Surely, if they are worried, if people are desperate enough that they feel that they need to do this kind of work to make money, then surely universities need to look into, you know, more financial support, ways to keep a limit on the costs of student accommodation. You know, I mean, the idea that this is a kind of lots of people are doing this, so we should teach them how to do it safely. It is completely insane, and I think it also just suggests that the kind of moral compass has gone kind of slightly wonky there. And I also think I think what's most wrong about it, as Melanie said, is the way in which it normalises it. It makes people think, oh, if I'm a bit short of cash, this seems to be a way to do it, and they'll teach me how to do it safely. I mean, it's completely, completely and utterly ridiculous.
It's interesting because it feeds into this new trend in approach to feminism. You know, the old sort of second wave feminists like me regard prostitution and pornography and all these things as, you know, exploitation and oppression of women. But there is this new, much more sort of liberal feminism that says that, hey, I'm a woman, I'm entitled to use my body how I want to use it. It's a great schism in sort of feminist thinking. And it reflects that. It feeds into that. But I just think it's so damaging for young women. There's loads of other casual work out there, you know, work in a shop or get a part-time job as a carer, and it's a lot better for you, I would have thought, than being exploited by a bloke.
That's Melanie Reid and James Forsyth there, giving us their take on the news. You can read James's column on a Friday, and Melanie's column is in the Saturday magazine of The Times. And if you pick up a copy of Saturday's paper, you'll also get my column, which is nice. You just need to get yourself a subscription. Go to thetimes.co.uk/timesredbox. Up next, when was the worst sleaze?
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
You're listening to the Red Box Podcast. Now, is Martin Bell right?
I am inclined to think that the present state of affairs is worse than it was in the late 90s.
Yes, sleaze has been back in the news this week. Well, it started last week, of course, with Owen Paterson. It's widened out quite a lot into MPs' second jobs too. Martin Bell speaking to Times Red Box earlier this week, saying he thought that what was going on now was worse than it was in the 1990s. So we're going to try and test that theory. Now, this week, of course, we've had Boris Johnson insisting, slightly oddly, on the world stage of the COP26 summit that Britain is not sleazy at all.
I genuinely believe that the UK is not remotely a corrupt country, nor do I believe that our institutions are corrupt. And I think it's very, very important to say that. We have a very, very tough system of parliamentary democracy and scrutiny, and not least by the media. I just want to say the most important thing is those who break the rules must be investigated and should be punished.
That was Boris Johnson speaking this week. But of course, he's not the first Prime Minister who's had to address questions of sleaze thrown at MPs. Let's wind back, well, more than a decade now. Here's Gordon Brown speaking in the House of Commons about the MPs' expenses scandal.
I think we all have a duty now to make sure that the agreements that we come to and the independent reviews that are made are such that can restore the confidence in the system. With regard to the proposal from the members' estimates, the members' allowance is committed last night. I think it is now very important, as they have suggested, that the receipts and the payments of members over the last 4 years be scrutinised by a body that includes people who are completely independent of the political system. And by doing that for all MPs over a period of 4 years, we can show the public we've taken every action that is necessary to deal with any anomalies, to repair them, and at the same time to build the confidence that is necessary in the political system for the future.
So that was Gordon Brown back in, 2009. Rewind more than a decade again, and here's John Major in 1997 on the Cash for Questions scandal.
I have made it clear from the very outset that these matters must be properly examined. Why else would I have set up the inquiries? Many people criticised me for doing so and said, why have you done this? You could have brushed it aside after a week of parliamentary difficulty and it would all have gone away. I didn't do that. And why didn't I do that? Because I happen to care about the reputation of Parliament in the short term and the long term. And if people have misbehaved, then it must be dealt with. But I am not going to bow to the witch hunt mentality of saying that anybody who faces unsubstantiated charges must leave public life.
That was John Major, way back in 1997, really banging the table there to make his point. So how does the news of the last week or so compare to what has come before? Let's speak to Christopher Hope, the chief political correspondent for The Telegraph, who's been reporting on the events of the last week or so, but was also part of the reporting team on the MP's expenses scandal too. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Matt.
Nice to have you with us. We've also got Heather Brook, the journalist who campaigned for the MP's expenses documents to be released way, way back in the mid-noughties. Hi, Heather.
Hi there. Hi.
And going back even further, David Henke is a journalist who broke some of the Cash for Questions stories back in 1994. Hi, David.
Hi.
Nice to have you with us. So, first of all, David, explain for people who... just so we can try and sort of put this into some context. What was, when we say the sleaze of the 1990s, what was the worst of it?
Well, really the worst of it, I mean, the story involved basically Mohammed El-Fayed being recommended by the time one of the biggest lobbying companies in Parliament, Ian Greer Associates, to pay members of Parliament to ask for questions, which is why it was called Cash for Questions. And altogether, the two MPs, Neil Hamilton, who actually today still denies this, and Tim Smith, who resigned as a minister straight afterwards, basically took about between them about £50,000. This led really us to on The Guardian to investigate the lobbying company. And basically when the story broke, the lobbying company and Hamilton decided to sue The Guardian. As a result, The Guardian got hold of the books of Ian Greer Associates. And when the case completely collapsed, it turned out that they weren't isolated cases. They were actually a number of other MPs who have been paid. And also Ian Greer altogether also provided his staff, or ordered his staff, to help MPs who were helpful to him in getting clients get re-elected. I was working during the election for them for free. And worse than that, Sir Gordon Downie then investigated this thoroughly. He was the parliamentary commissioner. And he discovered that the late Sir Michael Grills had actually been on a retainer of 10 grand a year for Greer for years, was getting bonuses and also share of the profits every time Greer got account. So it was a really serious corruption situation where MPs were basically getting on a gravy train to be paid through lobbyists for things they shouldn't be.
And I suppose a bit like how it's panned out again in the past couple of weeks, David, at the heart of it, there were some really serious, proper bad things going on. But then everything then around that is sort of, it's a sort of snowball effect of, you know, at the heart of it, really serious wrongdoing by MPs. And then it sort of picks up every other bit of, you know, whether it's MPs having affairs or, you know, sleaze just becomes this all encompassing thing, which creates the illusion, the impression that the major government was just mired in muck.
Yes, it did, actually. It actually triggered a whole lot of other issues, and people started investigating MPs for all sorts of things. But the thing that was good, as far as I was concerned, and you had the clip from Sir John Major, and this is the difference between him and Boris Johnson, his initial reaction, and he was himself embarrassed by this because he'd been the guest of honour at Ian Greer's 10th anniversary party, not knowing this was going on. And he basically then created the system we have today. And the difference is that Boris Johnson's initial reaction was actually to lower the standards, to reduce actually the scrutiny that MPs could face, which, in my mind, is one of the big points of the big points of the differences.
Okay, so that was the picture in the 90s. Heather Book, what first made you set about trying to get hold of the MPs' expenses? And when you started, when you fired off that first Freedom of Information request, presumably at that point you couldn't have known what you were going to ultimately unleash.
Yeah, that's right. I did it as part of a book I'd written called Your Right to Know. And it was timed to coincide with the introduction of the Freedom of Information Act in 2005. And it was, I basically just started to go through my own manuscript, making FOIs to different parts of the British state. And because I'd worked as a political reporter in America, one of the things I could get hold of was my local politicians' expense claims. And so that was something I thought would be a very easy sort of story where I could just duplicate that work I'd done previously.
Easy peasy. And easy peasy.
Yeah, exactly. And then I discovered they weren't public, and they had no intention of making them public. And so it became a very long sort of concerted battle between us, myself and at the time Speaker Michael Martin, who was representing the House of Parliamentary Authorities. But it wasn't just for expenses. It was also about, it was all the sort of things that we're talking about now in terms of parliamentary standards. So it was about staff, who could MPs hire as staff, how much were they paid, what work did they do. It was about travel expenses. It was about lobbying. It was all this sort of thing. And at the time, it was all incredibly opaque. It was just sort of like bulk figures. There was no way the public could really get any kind of detail to accurately interrogate how the money was, you know, public money was being spent. And that was what I was campaigning for, was this detailed financial information that the public, who I thought would be best placed to know if their MP was, you know, doing the work they were claiming to do, then if they had the accurate figures, the detailed figures, they could make a better, you know, decision about was this MP somebody that they felt that, you know, they wanted to vote for.
And of course, so it was in the process of you trying to get hold of the records through the sort of Freedom of Information process that, of course, they sort of scanned all of the receipts, but then they were going to go through this great process of redacting them when a whistleblower gets hold of the unredacted things and eventually takes it to the Daily Telegraph, which is where you were, Chris Hope.
That's right. Yes, it was all down to Heather's work on the FOI front that led it to fall into our hands at the Telegraph. And then we had, I suppose, the capacity and the team and the resource to present it in a kind of understandable way, because there were around 2 million photographed documents that you had to go through. You couldn't just search Duck House or Moat and it would cough up all these great stories. You had to go through each individual one. I remember vividly when we found Peter Vigors's, the late Peter Vigors's claim for a duck house. And it was turned down by the fees office at the time. But it was the early days of Google Earth, which I'm sure you're familiar with, Matt. And we got his address and we zoomed in on his big house somewhere near in Oxfordshire somewhere. And we saw an island in his lake. And on the island was a small duck house. And I said, you can see it from space. Which is one of the moments of the story. But yeah, but I think if you fast forward to now, the great work that, I mean, the lesson from David's story there is don't ever sue a newspaper, because the disclosure of documents is what gets you in the end. The lesson of Heather Brooks' brilliant work is FOI is lethal, and no wonder Tony Blair regretted it. The today's stories, I would argue, it's all out there. I mean, it's all declared. We know what Geoffrey Cox claims, forgive me, as a barrister. It's all known. And even the story in the Times today, which is a good one, that's these MPs, they can't claim mortgage allowance anymore because of the scandal that we did. Therefore, they've basically moved into another property in the capital, claiming on that, and they let out their own property for money. So, you know, essentially, the rules are the rules at the moment. I think what the complaints are about at the moment are about the rules, and are they a bit, you know, not tough enough on these MPs?
It was interesting. So Patrick Maguire in the Red Box email this morning had, I think it's a text exchange amongst Tory MPs. Nadine Dorris, who's the Culture Secretary, talking about how of those of us who were there in 2009 know what it was really like. The expenses scandal was a billion times worse than last week. The Duck House was a Conservative. Every single MP was in the media. Half a dozen MPs were banged into prison. Do you think that's fair? Because the Twitter poll that I've been running has got 56% of people think that the current sleaze is the worst. 33% say the MP's expenses. Only 11% going for yours, David, back in the cash of a question. I wonder if that's basically just recency bias, do you think, David? Or maybe there's something in it. One person I thought we made a very good point. That actually, the point is that each successive one is always worse because they haven't learnt the lessons of the previous ones. What do you think of that, David?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. And also, actually, Cash for Questions is a bit dim distance in the past now. But I think it is worse, actually. And the reason, actually, also is the sums of money. I mean, Cash for Questions, and compared with some of the sums people are claiming now, is sort of chicken feed. I mean, this was talking about people getting $5,000, and even in spent his money on. So the scale of it is much higher. I remember I once talked to the Germans about this. They had a session on it, and they actually thought Cash for Questions was quite small. They said they had very little fraud in Germany. When they had, it was really efficiently done and was for huge sums of money. We seem to be moving that way now, actually, in Britain.
Me too.
Heather, just on that, and actually, I suppose part of it is the thing. No matter how hard the opposition of the day might, you know, the Labour Party in the '90s try to stick it to the Tories, the Tory Party, actually David Cameron, you know, try to stick it to the Labour government in the over the expenses scandal, and now they've got the opposition trying to sort of stick it to the Tories in government again. Part of it is actually it sort of tarnishes everyone, really, doesn't it? And actually, no one is really on the moral high ground here, are they?
No, I don't think so. And one of the things Chris said about like lessons learned, I sort of the one of the reasons that expenses became such an explosive scandal was that they sort of people in Parliament continued to grip this idea that they could keep everything under their control and control the story. And so when the disc was, you know, was leaked, instead of just making it public, which all that data was meant to be public in the first place, like that's what the whole court case was about, they refused to make it public. And so they basically handed the Telegraph like a month long, I think maybe even a month and a half, Chris will know, exclusive on all that information, which had then created like an even bigger story that tainted everyone.
I remember that well. The paper I worked for. Everyone just waited. You sat around doing nothing all day, just waiting for the Telegraph. Yeah.
And I did think there was a little element of that with the Owen Paterson story, that, you know, this sort of arrogant idea that, you know, they could control the way that panned out. Instead of just accepting sort of responsibility and accountability, they were trying to sort of force their will, and then it all horribly backfired and just sort of created this, you know, this sort of slime across the whole institution.
And that's everyone gets covered in it, I would really like them to learn, once
something bad has happened, like just own it and take responsibility, and then, you know, learn from it and move on. Don't try to cover it up, because that just creates more disaster.
Just finally, then, in a word or two, I want to ask you all, which do you think was the worst of it all? David Hankey, first of all.
What, the present scandal?
The 90s, the noughties, or now?
I mean, the worst thing I think was at the moment was the Prime Minister's initial reaction, which was to find some way of actually making it less accountable, which, as you rightly say, is much more difficult. It was actually in the 1990s, and there was no internet at all, so it was quite difficult to get information on this, whereas now it's all out in the open.
Heather, the 90s, noughties, or now?
I think the money what David said, the money sums that we're talking about now, and the closeness between big business and government in Britain is kind of starting to replicate a lot of the, you know, the corruption that you've seen in America. So I think that while all of them have a similar root, which is powerful people trying to avoid accountability, I think that now, because of the times we're in and the amounts of money, I think now is probably the most worrying.
Just finally, then, in a word or two, Chris, which was the worst, the 90s, the noughties, or now?
Well, I would say definitely the noughties, because MPs went to prison on the back of that story, and that hasn't happened yet. I think no one knew how bad it was. And what was amazing, of course, was the Parliament then published all of the redacted pages of all these expenses after we had dealt with the unredacted ones. I mean, they were trying to hide it all, but the horse has bolted. It was absurd, classically absurd Parliament moment. Definitely the noughties. I stand by that one.
That's all we've got time for on this episode of the Red Box Podcast. Don't forget you can listen to me live Monday to Friday, 10 till 1 on Times Radio. We bring you the best bits here on the podcast. And if you're feeling particularly nice, why not wait and review us wherever you get your podcasts from?
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.